You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/bcp.
Welcome to Brookings. I am not Dr. Fred Harris. I am Dr. Nicole Turner-Lee. Dr. Harris, we wanted him to stay home because he's not feeling too well. In good old New York City, so I think that's a good distance between him and us. We're excited here at Brookings to have this conversation. As many of us know right now, there's a important confirmation hearing going on where this particular topic has come up several times. I am a fellow here at Brookings in the Governance Studies Department, which is actually hosting this great discussion today, and I'm joined by just an esteemed and distinguished group of people, one of which my dear friend has decided to come and join us. So actually, why don't we just do this now since you came out and shook everybody's hand. Give Reverend Jesse Jackson a round of applause. And I will go through and announce everybody who is here in their position, but I'd like to just give just some overlay for why we thought it was an important conversation and debate to have here at the institution. I mean, first and foremost, without delving too deeply into the conversation that's happening now on the Hill with regards to the new Attorney General, clearly there have been some efforts starting and dating back to 1965 with putting in place a Voting Rights Act, which ensured the type of racial equity and equality of a basic and inalienable right, which is the right to vote. And as we have seen, for those of you who follow this debate very closely, just 3 years ago or 4 years ago now, we encountered a decision whereas the Supreme Court overturned what was called the preclearance provision in the Voting Rights Act, Section 5 to be more specific, which allowed states to basically go beyond federal preclearance or the relevant agencies to change their voting rights. That had a peculiar impact, and we'll talk about this on the panel with regards to that particular case in that particular county, but it also spoke volumes to the protection of the VRA under what used to be the Obama administration to what we will now see under President-elect Trump. So this conversation is very timely. It's very sensitive. It is probably one of the pillars in the confirmation hearings for what we expect an attorney general to do, which is the preservation and the enforcement of civil rights. And so I'm excited to have a group of professionals that will be joining us, in addition to one of my favorite people, which we will kick off with, which is Congressman G.K. Butterfield, who is sneaking in quietly, who is a Democrat out of North Carolina that was intricately involved not only in the Shelby County case, but also the ramifications of that case, particularly in what the North Carolina District Court did around voter ID laws. So with that, let me go ahead and just introduce everybody, and then we will put it in an order, and we will get into the brunt of the conversation. We will be joined first, and I am particularly very grateful that this, I'm going to call you young man, sir, right, has come out and joined us. He's been a fan and supporter, and I've been a fan and supporter of him, and he's been just wonderful in my lifetime here in Washington, D.C., and that's Honorable G.K. Butterfield, who just joined us, who represents, yep. North Carolina's 1st Congressional District in the U.S. House of Representatives, and he serves in the Democratic leadership as Chief Deputy Whip and former chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, just came out of that tenure. And he sits on the Influential Committee on Energy and Commerce as the fifth most senior Democrat, also on the Health Subcommittee. And just a vocal advocate as a former federal judge on this issue, and we hope to hear in just some brief remarks as he has taken his time out today what he believes about this particular issue. Seated beside me to my left is the Reverend Jesse Lewis Jackson, Sr., founder and president of Rainbow Push Coalition, who is one of the foremost leaders when it comes to the legacies of civil rights. He was there, he talks about it, and he hasn't stopped talking about it. And he also happens to be a friend and a mentor to me in my journey to understand civil rights. And in particular, under President Clinton, outside of being the 1984 presidential candidate for president, he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, which is the nation's highest civilian honor. Let's give him a round of applause. Sitting next to him is another dear friend. I'm just still surrounded by friends. I don't know what to do. Stephanie Brown James, who's the CEO and founding partner of Vestive Strategies, a Washington, D.C.-based community engagement firm that specializes in grassroots community and civic engagement strategies. She's also the co-founder of the Political Action Committee, The Collective, which is designed to build black political power nationwide. And she served as the former black youth vote director for the President Obama's campaign. And I do have to say, in terms of a collective pack, it was a result of her efforts of organizing that the Congressional Black Caucus increased their membership of members, particularly in the Senate. So give a round of applause to Stephanie Brown James. Another dear friend, I just bunch y'all up here, right? Hillary Shelton, who serves as the Senior Vice President for Policy and Advocacy and Director of the NAACP's Washington Bureau, for which his CEO actually testified before the Hill, and we'll have copies of that testimony available. It's powerful. In his role, he's responsible for federal legislative and national public policy over the 500,000 member, 2,200 membership unit of national civil rights organizations. He's well known on television, on radio as well, in talking about issues related to voting rights and equal justice. Thank you, Hillary.
Thank you. That's good for you.
Myrna Perez, my new friend, is Deputy Director of the Brennan Center's Democracy Program and leader of the Center's Voting Rights and Elections Project. So she's an expert in voting rights and election administration, in addition to being nationally recognized author of reports and articles, particularly an expert on what we're going to talk about with several of the jurisdictional cases that were debated and actually were able to counter some of the challenges to the Voting Rights Act. So Myrna Perez. And last but certainly not least is Clarissa Martinez de Castro. I got a cousin named that. and she's the Deputy Vice President of the National Casa de Raza, the largest Latino rights, civil rights, and advocacy organization in the U.S., where she leads their work on fair and effective immigration policies, as well as efforts to lead Latino civic engagement. So with that in mind, I'm going to ask, give a round of applause to Clarissa. With that in mind, we're going to start with my dear friend, Congressman G.K. Butterfield, who has joined us here at Brookings to start the conversation.
Thank you, and good afternoon, one and all.
Good afternoon.
Now, Nicole, you did not tell me what the time constraints are this afternoon.
So just keep it
I'm going to assume 3 to 4 minutes. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's right.
All right. Let me bring greetings to you from the Jeff Sessions hearing, which I just left a few moments ago. It's a very interesting hearing, to say the least, and it's very important. So thank you for your passion. Thank you for your willingness to have this conversation today, because it is critically important. There's no subject that we could talk about that's more important to democracy than voting rights. And to understand voting rights, you have to go back many years, and I don't have the time to connect the dots and to put it all together for you. But I will simply start in 1900. In 1900, African Americans were actively participating in the electoral process in the South. In my state of North Carolina, African American men were registered to vote, and they were doing great things. In South Carolina, the same thing. More than 20 African Americans were elected to Congress during the Reconstruction era. But all of that came to an end in 1900 with the disfranchisement laws that created the literacy tests and the poll tax and the other devices that were used to disenfranchise African Americans. And so starting in 1900, people of color, African Americans, did not have the ability to participate meaningfully in the political process in the South. Let me tell you a personal story. In 1928, my dad, who was a black man from Bermuda, married my mother, who was a Southern African American woman whose grandfather was a slave owner. That accounts for some of this. My dad married my mother, came to North Carolina in 1928 as a young African-American doctor, dentist, moved into the community, and the white establishment called him in and said, "We're going to do you a favor. We're going to arrange for you to become a registered voter in this community." And he did indeed become a registered voter. And after that, he started a journey to try to get other African Americans in the community registered to vote. And he met massive resistance, as you can imagine. But finally, at the turn of 1950s came along, and my dad continued to want to register people to vote. In 1953, he had registered enough African Americans in my community in Ward 3, which is a subpart of my city, Ward 3. He had registered enough African Americans, that so much so that he decided he wanted to run for the city council from that ward. He ran in 1953. It was a tie vote. They put both names in a container, reached in there, and lo and behold, it was my dad. Well, that was a seismic moment in my community. And all of a sudden, the fathers of the city figured out that they did not need district elections in order to have city council. And so they immediately changed from district elections to at-large elections. And in the next election, 1957, he lost, and he lost miserably. And from that day forward, we did not have any African Americans serving on the city council. So finally, 1965 comes along, and the Voting Rights Act is enacted into law. And the Voting Rights Act, very powerful piece of legislation. Most of you know a lot about the Voting Rights Act. But essentially, and this is the way I explain it back at home, essentially the Voting Rights Act did many things, but it did three things. First of all, it did away with the literacy tests. Second thing it did was to create a Section 2 which gives African-American communities the right to bring lawsuits. Later it was expanded to other communities of color to bring lawsuits if they feel that their vote is being diluted in any manner. The third thing was Section 5, which gave the Attorney General preclearance power to reject voting changes that were discriminatory against minority communities. And so the Voting Rights Act, starting in 1965, was a very powerful piece of legislation. In the beginning, Republicans hated the Voting Rights Act. They said it was a states' rights issue, that the federal government had no right implementing a Section 5 and a Section 2, and that the federal government needed to stay out of it. But as the years rolled on, and Reverend Jackson can certainly speak to this better than I can, or as well as I can, as the years rolled on, the Republicans figured this thing out. We're going to embrace the Voting Rights Act, and we're going to say that the Voting Rights Act requires us Republicans, when we redraw the lines, to protect minority voting interests. And so as a result of that new idea that the Republicans came up with, and they've implemented it all across the South, they have now redrawn congressional districts and legislative districts, particularly in the South, in such a manner as to protect African-American communities, but at the expense of other communities that are progressive in the South. And so we've got a lot of litigation going on. I will simply tell you in closing that the federal courts have thrown out the legislative redistricting map in North Carolina as being a racial gerrymander, thrown out the congressional map as a racial gerrymander. But last night, we've got an emergency phone call that the U.S. Supreme Court stepped in yesterday and stayed the trial court's, the district court's decision to stop the legislative races and to allow and to require redistricting in North Carolina. They have stayed the lower court's decision, and now the U.S. Supreme Court is going to have to speak as to what extent states can go in drawing boundaries. And when does racial gerrymandering become unconstitutional? That's going to be a question that's going to have to be addressed very soon, and so stay tuned as we go forward. But because of the redistricting power of these southern legislatures, we have now lost more than 400 or 500, not just African-American, but progressive politicians in the South who have been elected to state legislatures. They have now switched from the majority party to the minority party, and they now find themselves with very little or no influence. So thank you for having this panel today. You have a star-studded panel. I look forward to hearing some of their testimony, but I've got to get back to Jeff Sessions and to make sure that he is defeated. Thank you very much. All right.
Thank you, Congressman, and thank you for that intel as to the recent development. So I want to jump right into the panel, and I think I'm going to go this way so we can land up with my friend here just sort of giving us a summation of where we are. So the Congressman laid out the Shelby County versus Holden decision. As you see, there's been a new development that's coming down the pipe. There's been obviously some contention and challenge by North Carolina, the district courts were actually as it was said, that North Carolina in particular saw the surgical precision of racial discrimination manifesting itself in voter ID laws and other laws. Give us some reaction on where we are then with voter registration and turnout given the 2013 Shelby decision. Have we made progress? Are we going back? And if everybody could just comment on that for about 3 to 4 minutes, that would be great.
I think the overarching question here is, why is it at a time where we're seeing lower participation among the American electorate, that the conversation we're having is dominated by actions and measures that intend to make it harder for every American who is eligible to actually be able to participate in the process? I think that's the overarching question. And obviously there's disparate impact of some of those actions and measures on communities of color, and particularly communities whose voting power is growing. So there's no coincidence between these actions, between the impact, and I would argue the intent of some of these attempts. And with Shelby, that's very clear, right? If you look at what were the immediate actions generated by the Shelby decision, I think there is no doubt about the impact, but the intent of what Shelby was after. And I'll read you a quick couple of things from a very extensive report that I know some of my colleagues are also going to talk about. But again, if there was any doubt, within 2 hours of the Shelby County decision, the Texas Attorney General announced that the state's photo ID law, previously rejected by a federal court as the most discriminatory measure of its kind in the country, would immediately go into effect. Again, before Shelby, that was on hold. They couldn't have moved forward. It went forward immediately, even though it was a discriminatory law. More recently, you saw it on your TVs in the primary season just this last year, where in Arizona, Maricopa County made a decision to reduce polling locations by 70%, creating lines for people having to wait up to 5 hours, a decision that would have required pre-clearance before Shelby. So imagine if you are an average American voter who, unlike many of us in this room, doesn't have the flexibility to tell the boss, I'm going to take a couple of hours to go vote in the morning. You have to show up to work at a particular time, and you get to leave at a particular time, and chances are your job is nowhere near where you live. And you try to go vote, and you are faced with having to wait for 5 hours. But you don't have that flexibility. Or even trying to make it back from that job if you only have one. Try to make it back to the polling location that it's near where you live and far away from where you work and having to wait 5 hours. So the reality is that voter suppression is alive and well. In many ways, it's happening in more benign forms, if you would, and under the cloak of legality based on what happens with these decisions. The other thing that has been interesting about the whole conversation on voting rights is that, you know, the way that a lot of stories flow these days where they are portrayed as being the purview of one community or another or one group of Americans but not another, is that largely it has been presented as something that affects African Americans. First of all, I think that the state of our democracy is something that is existential for all of us, regardless of what community we identify with. It is certainly existential for those who are bearing the burden of where these restrictions are happening. And so particularly for Latinos, access to the franchise, to the voting booth, it's existential. We're talking about a community where 76% of Latinos in this country are United States citizens. We have 12 million of our citizens who are eligible to register who still haven't been able to do so. And so we need to make sure that those access channels grow. And we are adding 1 more million every year. So when we talk about measures that are intended to diminish the access people have to register to vote, to be able to vote once registered, we are talking about a naked attempt to quiet, if not completely mute, the voice of those communities, and frankly, their fellow Americans that are equally situated, either geographically, politically, or otherwise, right? So I think that in many ways our communities are the canary in the mine, but we should not assume that the impact of these legislation, of these measures, is something that only affects communities of color, and it is indeed an existential threat to our democracy.
Thank you, Clarissa. Myrna, what do you think? What can you add on to that?
Buenas tardes. I'm Mirna Perez. I direct the voting work for the nonpartisan Brenner Center for Justice. What I would say to add on to my friend and former roommate, Gladysa, is that the struggle over the right to vote didn't happen with Shelby County. It's been part of our country's history. It's baked into our DNA. But it became a very big flashpoint after 2010 when we saw a wave of restrictive legislation just almost out of nowhere blanket the country. We saw states trying to cut back early voting, states trying to end Election Day registration, states imposing strict proof of citizenship legislation, and then a lot of strict photo ID laws, which tend to suck up most of the oxygen. So that meant going into 2016, not only did we not have the Voting Rights Act, we had 14 states in which the Americans in those states found it harder to vote than they had found it in the prior presidential election. The bright spot in all of this is it could have been a whole lot worse had the Department of Justice and the private bar and nonpartisan voting rights lawyers like myself had stepped in. One of the things that I want to focus on a little bit in my brief time is in the state of Texas. That's where I'm from. I'm one of the litigators in the Texas photo ID case. And to Gladysa's point, Texas had a voter ID law before it passed this really strict one. And in the course of the time that it existed, which was a period of about a decade, it had done a very, very successful job of trying to make sure that people were who they say they were when they decided to vote. I want people to guess how many people think were found to have been committers or perpetrators of voter fraud between 2000 and 2014 in the state of Texas. Go ahead. Yeah, we had two between 2000 and 2010 and two more between 2012 and 2014, right? And I had more people in the courtroom who were unable to vote because of this law than had happened in the entire period. And that happened because people were concerned about the demographic changes that were happening in Texas. But thankfully, we were able to blunt that law in a very material way. So that voters who didn't have the kind of identification that was required and voters who were going to have a hard time getting it would be able to have a way that they could cast a ballot that would count. There was also great successes in a number of other states. The Omnibus North Carolina bill didn't go into effect as planned. The Wisconsin bill, which didn't that was challenged and didn't have the outcome that the lawyers hoped, was a lot better off. The voters in Wisconsin were a lot better off than they had prior to the legislation that had started. Proof of citizenship requirements in Kansas and Arizona had been severely blunted. The reason we did not have this catastrophic disaster of our democracy on the fact of these laws was because there was a ton of resources being pumped into from the private bar, from the nonpartisan groups, from the Department of Justice. And if we cannot rely on those particular pillars protecting us, we're going to have a democracy in which people take it for their own. And if we tarnish our right to vote in that way, we are not going to be in a position where we can have the robustness and the participation and the good policymaking that that happens when you have a reflective democracy. I'm hoping we will have some time to talk a little bit more specific about what things actually mean, because I think part of what this conversation can do is push back on some of the tropes that we see people happening. So if somebody asks what happened to registration after Shelby County, I'll say Shelby County didn't just mess up registration. It allowed people to close polling locations. It allows people to impose strict photo ID laws. It allows people to change the requirements for where the district lines are being drawn. I think there's a lot of what is, I think a lot of the conversations often get reduced to tropes, and I'm hoping that throughout this we'll have some time to get a little bit in depth. But the upshot is that our right to vote is threatened, our right to vote is important, and it is not going to be protected unless we all stand up and say no more.
Thank you, Myrna. Hillary?
No, thank you very much. Let me first thank you all for being here, but also thank my friend Nicole Turner Lee for getting us all into kind of trouble sitting here together. A couple of things is these are all my heroes in the movement for voting rights throughout the United States and certainly here in Washington, D.C., and I'm just delighted to call them my friends, colleagues, and partners in this fight. It's also, in true Washington tone, let me also invoke I want to associate myself with the comments of my colleagues because they are all absolutely right as they talk about the issues and challenges of the Voting Rights Act. Just a couple things about first what happens when you eliminate Section 5. When you hear numbers and codes and things like that, it doesn't really personalize or actualize the problem that we're having. Let me do that for you right now. The reason Section 5 was so important as a preclearance is because all the states and jurisdictions that were covered under Section 5, meaning before you can make any changes to the time, the place, or the manner in which a voting process goes on at the state level, because of their bad behavior, because of their disenfranchising processes, they have to take it to the Department of Justice, Voting Rights Division, or to a panel of three jurors made up of the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals before you can make any changes to make sure we won't have the same kind of discrimination that placed them under Section 5 in the first place. So in essence, it doesn't cover everyone, but it covers just those places that have the bad behavior of disenfranchising African Americans, many other racial and ethnic minorities, and other individuals in our society from being able to cast an unfettered vote and, in effect, have it accounted. So what we have now is states like Alabama, the place that the case came from in the first place. Alabama had a treacherous history of disenfranchising racial and ethnic minorities, preventing us from being able to vote. How else could you end up with a state that was nearly 40% African American but could not deliver one member of Congress? The kind of disenfranchising practices were outrageous. If you want to see how a lot of this stuff plays out, when you get home, Google congressional districts in Alabama and Mississippi and South Carolina, and what you'll see looks more like a Rorschach test than it should have been districts and counties and the like that will be covered by something like this. That's important. What you did was eliminate the preclearance provision because we know how elections go. If indeed election day happens and discrimination occurs, whoever got disenfranchised just got stuck. In essence, once the outcome of the election happens, they don't do do-overs. Otherwise, we'd probably be doing over this particular election, if you know what I'm saying. How will it end up with 3 million Americans? We'll go through that process in a minute as well as we talk about these concerns. So from our perspective, as we talk about the challenges and the problems, we have to have those protections in place. Otherwise, we disenfranchise more. And that's just another big word for saying many Americans, based on who you are and where you live, are locked out of the process of being able to exercise the franchise, the right to be able to cast your vote and have your voice heard as we determine not only who will be president and vice president, but everything else down ballot all the way down to and including the dog catcher. That's important to all of us as we think about how these issues move forward. Those protections need to be there. So as we move ahead, there are pieces of legislation that are now in place. Well, we'll be reintroducing legislation. Let me put it in those terms. We had bipartisan support to fix the Voting Rights Act. Jim Sensenbrenner, quite frankly, from Wisconsin, deserves a lot of credit on the Republican side of the equation. Sensenbrenner was one of those that actually worked with us very closely, along with John Conyers and along with North Carolina, about not to call his name.
Watt.
Mel Watt, thank you so very much. Mel Watt, who was on the Judiciary Committee at the time, crafted a structure to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act of 1965 in 2006. Here's the craziness as I go to leave this alone. We had nearly a unanimous vote to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act in 06. We had an absolutely unanimous vote in the U.S. Senate to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act of 1965 in 2006. For some reason, even after 21,000 pages of testimony, after 21 different hearings that were held on the House and the Senate side on this very issue. After a very thorough review of the overall Voting Rights Act, including Section 5, the Supreme Court came back in a 5-4 decision saying that there was not serious consideration of Section 5, and as such, we're going to get rid of Section 4B, which is the tool, not to get too complicated. Section 5 is the provision that says you have to be able to demonstrate a number of things before you can make changes to the time, place, or manner. Section 4B is the provision that says who is covered and how they're covered under Section 5. So in essence, it's kind of like you got this car of voting rights that's souped up and ready to go. Section 4B was the key to the car, and they took the key away. In essence, it cannot be used at all as it is now. Section 2 is talked about oftentimes as the fix. Let me roll out this as well. Section 2 is a very helpful tool that you can utilize when voter discrimination happens when you go to the polls. Here's the problem. Section 2 can only be utilized when you first determine that discrimination has occurred.
Right.
So even though you have all these jurisdictions and full states that have a long history of discrimination, all kind of things that disenfranchise all kinds of people, that now they can go about doing it freely. And let me leave with a couple of numbers, then we'll move on to the next one. When we looked at how this affects them, some of us would say, well, maybe Brother Shelton, you're being just a little bit paranoid. And that might be the case. But if my mom is there, just because I'm paranoid don't mean they're not out to get me. Because here's the final conclusion. When we looked at states like North Carolina, what we realized when we looked at those that would have to meet the new stringent photo ID requirement, a requirement that, by the way, across the board was held back by the Justice Department under Eric Holder, saying, if you implement it this way, there will be discrimination, and as such, you cannot make that change. So in essence, as we moved along those lines and went on to take on that issue as well, we looked at North Carolina and determined that there were about 630,000 North Carolinians that did not have the requisite photo ID to be able to cast that unfettered vote. When we looked at even, we had a little problem with Pennsylvania as well. Right. Though Pennsylvania is not covered by the Voting Rights Act, they want to also implement photo IDs. Though they had only two cases of those pretending to be someone that they're not and trying to cast that vote. We caught them, of course, those two. But with that, they wanted to make a change that would affect everyone. 635 Pennsylvanians did not have the requisite ID to cast that unfettered vote. Someone has to check these numbers, because let me also say this. Barack Obama won North Carolina, quite frankly, the same year we did this study, by about 610,000 votes. Mm-hmm. In essence, if you don't think it's partisan, oftentimes the way the game gets played, we won't call it that, but here's what the effect will be. Whether we're talking about grandfather clauses, does it say apply to everyone? Poll taxes, they say to apply to everyone. And even we had something called jelly bean tests, for y'all who are not familiar. In essence, when you went to the polling place to vote, there was a big jar of jelly beans sitting on the table next to your voter registration, mm-hmm. your voter registration material. They would ask everyone that came in the room to tell them how many jelly beans were in that jar. For some reason, black folks' interpretation of the use of space for jelly beans was very different than white folks' interpretations. Because every single time we got it right, and no matter what the number is they use, we got it wrong.
Oh, right.
And then whatever the number is they use, they got it right.
Right.
In essence, real problems, still need these, let it go at that.
That's right. Stephanie, I'll have you just chime in and we'll come back to you too, because you've been in the trenches actually trying to register people. But just any reaction before we go to Reverend on what we're seeing, just so everybody kind of hears from everybody.
And I just want to say thank you so much, Nicole, for pulling us together, and also for this beautiful setup of having me sit between these two gentlemen here, who I joined NAACP when I was 14 years old. And just a couple of years ago. And these two gentlemen are definitely reasons why I've continued to stay engaged in the social justice movement. And so I'm just grateful to be here with everyone on the stage today. Just a quick story. So as I mentioned, my background is primarily in civil rights and social justice. I worked for NAACP for a number of years in different positions. I ended up as National Field Director and Director of the Youth and College Division in 2011 when I received the opportunity of a lifetime to join President Obama's reelection campaign in 2012 to serve as his National African American Vote Director, which I thought there could be no greater role in the world than to take this job. And then I get there and it's like, okay, this job sucks. because contrary to popular belief at the time, everyone, including black people in the country, were not the biggest fans of Barack Obama in 2011 and 2012. I mean, what we found as we went across the country and organized and had conversations with communities is that a lot of people felt as though the hope and the dreams and the goals and the aspirations that they thought they would see as a result of Barack Obama's first 4 years in office maybe wasn't exactly what transpired, and they had some kind of ill will feelings and didn't feel as though their vote was important. And so we realized very early on in the campaign that we would have to put in a lot of effort, a lot of sweat equity, a lot of boots on the ground to make sure that we had conversations one-on-one with voters across the country to let them know why it was important to keep Barack Obama in office in November of 2014. And to say that I was wonderfully surprised as the election results came in November is definitely an understatement. You could have never told me that through the effort of our organization and nonprofit organizations and civil rights groups and community and civic agencies across the country that we would end up with the highest African-American voter turnout ever in history. 2008 was historic, and we've heard time after time again, oh, that will never be repeated. The fact that we not only repeated that but exceeded turnout in many states like Michigan, Ohio, Virginia, in the black community was tremendous. And the feeling of pride that so many of our organizers and voters had was just infectious. And I can remember towards the end of the campaign, I was able to work in my hometown of Cleveland, and we had some volunteers who, some of whom did not have the right to vote because they had some run-ins with the law. We had some young people who it was their first time getting engaged in the voting process, and we met up a few days after the election, and some of them had very sad faces. And I'm like, you should be excited still. You know, I'm like, I'm still on cloud nine. And they're like, well, you know, this one young lady said, well, I was looking at the news and they're not talking about the historic black voter turnout that we had. They're saying that, you know, black voters turned out to vote because they were fueled by the voter suppression that they faced. Mm-hmm. And it made me really pause. Because something that we don't talk about enough is the psychological and emotional impact of disenfranchisement on people who work very hard to turn out the vote and to empower their communities. And so as opposed to the narrative being about people in the community understanding the correlation between their vote and policies getting enacted to make their community stronger, the narrative was, well, black people came out to vote because they wanted to show white people that no matter what laws you put in place, we will supersede them. We will make sure we exercise our right to vote. When sure, that could be the case in some communities, but the power must belong and rest in the community to say, I want to exercise my vote because I know it makes a difference, not because of the fear that someone is trying to incite to say this is to prevent you, and so you need to overcome this. And so one of the things that I hope that we keep at the top of our minds as we're thinking about some of the ramifications of disenfranchisement is also that we need to make sure that we have representative politics, representative leadership in our government to also go hand in hand with the reason why people need to vote in the first place. Because at the end of the day, we can talk about all the laws that have been put in place to restrict voters, but if we're also not talking about at the same time the positive reasons why we need to communicate to the community to vote, then we will continue to have a low voter turnout, which I'm so afraid of, that, and I don't think we'll have it in the next midterm election. But we can't go back to 2014 where we had 37% of eligible voters vote, which was a 70-year low in this country. And many of those people didn't vote because they didn't tie the importance of voting for your local and your state legislator leaders, which in turn leaders who decide what voting laws are going to be in place in your states. So that's definitely something I want to continue to explore.
Yeah, I mean, this is all interesting. So, Reverend, I'm going to toss it over to you now, because I think what we've heard so far is this conversation that sort of has evolved from historical reasons, legal and constitutional reasons, now the psychological or socio-emotional connection to why voting is important, which makes a lot of sense now, given where we've come out of the election. And we're not going to talk about it yet, given where we are with the potential confirmation of the Attorney General, right? That office that has basically been the place to enforce voter protection. So, Reverend, I want to turn over to you. I mean, you've seen this. You've been engaged in this. Shelby County, change the rules, right? So how should we contextualize this conversation in terms of voter registration, enrollment, enforcement today, I think what Stephanie's talking about, and going back to what our other panelists have referenced.
Thank you. Nicole and to fellow panelists. Jefferson Beauregard Sessions.
The third.
Is named after Jefferson Davis, the Confederate leader to secede from the Union. Beauregard is one of the Confederate generals. He is a dyed-in-the-wool Confederate. So calling him racist and non-racist misses the philosophical issue of states versus Union, slave versus free. I listened to President Barack last night. I was inspired by his address last night, and he made a reference to 40 years of our democracy. Hillary referenced it, and some others during the campaign referenced it. 240 assumes democracy started 1776. We arrived in 1619. We were here 157 years before 1776. We were non-people. That was slaveocracy. Even when we got the right, got the 13th Amendment in 1865, it was not the 1870 that we could vote 5 years. That was a debate even then, 5 years later. And then when the troops were withdrawn, we voted to Reconstruction against, 5,000 blacks were lynched between 1880 and 1940, driven north as refugees, not looking for a job, looking just to be spared to live, all about the vote. We had 8 black congressmen from South Carolina during that season, 8. They drove us out of the South amidst walk from Columbia to Arkansas. This is a very tortured history of terror around the right to vote. Fast forward. 1965, the right to vote, the first time protected right since 1860. 85 years. Blacks couldn't vote in the South without protection. White women couldn't serve on juries. 18-year-olds who were serving in Vietnam could not vote. You couldn't vote on college campuses. You couldn't vote bilingually. In the 1988, you could not vote proportionately. All these were evolution rule changes. We thought once we had the right to vote, come out of the settlement, it was all over. The burden shifted to us, prove you can vote. We did not understand gerrymandering, annexation, at-large, roll purging, people going to jail trying to register voters, as in the case of Dr. King's staff members, Alvin and Mrs. Turner, whose Sessions tried to send to jail for 250 years for voter protection. Cannot separate him from the lineage of voter suppression. Today's Republicans, by and large, were yesterday's Jefferson Davis Democrats. Became Thurman, Goldwater, Reagan Democrats in 1965. They changed parties, but not ideologies. They ceased to be racist and became conservatives. There are no more racists now. They're conservatives. In the name of, I'm not sure what all the name of. I'm trying to go somewhere with this. Is that we lost this election. The Russians, with their attacks, helped to create a climate disrupt, discredit Hillary Clinton's, with the crooked Hillary, all that stuff coming together, argument about Electoral College. Our votes, we were hacked by Republicans. Republicans hacked our vote in North Carolina. On November the 9th, the New York Times lead editorial, the North Carolina chairman celebrated the fact that we were able to suppress the black vote by 8.5% and increase the white by 21%. That didn't even turn out. They had to do with go to Winston-Salem State's campus. 7,000 students had to walk 3 miles down the road to vote. Took voting off of campuses. This was hacking. hacking the black vote. Putin, not Putin and Russia, but Republicans that did spend no time on registration, all the time was spent on hacking the vote. In Pennsylvania, vote hacking. In the city of Milwaukee. And 75,000 voters in Michigan voted, and no one voted for the top of the ticket. Can you imagine people voting for the bottom of the ticket up? 75,000 voters who had not voted the top of the ticket. You know, that's voter suppression. And I guess I'm alarmed at how silent Democrats have been in not fighting for the protected vote. Mm. They lost by the margin of the stolen vote. We threw the towel in too quick. It was not the margin of the Electoral College, which is anachronistic. It was not the margin of the disruptive schemes of Putin, as it was Republican by design. What they call voter fraud was absolute voter suppression, dash voter hacking. That's enough for me right now. Come back.
So, no, I mean, this is, thank you for that information, right? But this is interesting, right? I want to throw it back to the panel, and anybody can answer this, particularly Clarissa, Myrna, or Hillary. So what Reverend has laid out is this sort of the invalidation of the VRA in such a way that you do not have the support from the Congress, because technically we will be in a unified Republican Congress, a unified Republican White House, and a unified Republican Supreme Court. So the question becomes, what can be done? What will the appeals look like to Congress to restore parts of this act? And then I'll get back to the Attorney General confirmation being part of that.
May I ask the point, though? Mm-hmm. If you work here and get paid and go home and get robbed between in your house, right. There's something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm. There's something wrong with the house.
Or something wrong with the robber.
Right.
There's something wrong with you. Should you stop working as a reaction to your money got stolen? We've not reacted to the robber.
Right. Well, let's talk about that.
We react as if the robber does not, those who denied the right to vote in 1965, who stopped the vote in 2000, suppressed it in 2016.
Right.
That is not at all subtle. Our vote was stolen.
Strategically
and targeted. Mm-hmm. That's why the Supreme Court said it was surgically.
Precision surgery.
North Carolina. Yep. I mean, the target of the vote in Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and in Texas, Michigan. And it's as if the first narrative was she did a good campaign, but somehow she didn't win because she didn't get the Electoral College. Electoral College got stolen. Second, it wasn't them. The real deal was everybody knows about, you know, the fact is Putin did whatever he did, but the reality is that had no effect on the campaign. The hell if it didn't. You know it did. If you leak 30 days in a row, it's like Jesus on one day he is Hosanna, Hosanna, and a week later crucify him, because government propaganda can destroy people's will. 30 days of she is a crook.
Right. So wait.
No, help me now.
No, we hear the other.
My point is, I'm listening to these narratives about Russia hacking doesn't matter the outcome. It does matter. Between Russia hacking and Comey, it does matter.
That's right.
Stealing votes does matter, and so I'm overwhelmed by the notion that somehow we did something wrong and lost. We did something right and faced thievery.
That's right. And I want to actually get back to that, because perhaps, and just hold that thought, Reverend, because perhaps we need to go back to protests as a way to actually reclaim that. But I want to also know, do we have a chance to work within Congress? Do we have a chance to reappeal back to the Supreme Court? So I know, Hillary, you talked about the voter advancement action.
Sure. The short answer is it's in our hands. We've got a Congress that 435 of them want to get reelected again in 2 years. One-third of the Senate wants to get reelected as well. Mm-hmm. So in essence, it's really in our hands of what we end up with, but there are some options on the table we have to go with. It's a two-prone approach. The first prone is we're going to have to fix what we have, because it's extremely helpful in making sure that the right to vote is something that's enjoyed by most everyone. But let me also say this, it wasn't even perfect then, but it was much better than it is now. When you have a system that's set in place, it's a good, makes sense system that doesn't blame everyone, but when you do have those that have committed the crime under Reverend Jackson's analysis, and it happens more often than we want to admit, But we have those that we know have done that before they can make the disenfranchising changes, they have to go through a preclearance. Let's have someone set in place that takes a look at your plan and makes sure you didn't leave out all those people of Latino descent that live in this community as well, or all those people of African-American descent that live in a particular neighborhood, or others that get disenfranchised as well. So first, the first step is we've got to repair the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Section 5 must become operational again. And again, we have bipartisan support for it, but we have some elitists, quite frankly, that recognize that even a broken electoral system works for them. Mm-hmm. But it does not work for the American people or the integrity of our democratic small D system of governance. First step. Second is, even at before the Supreme Court's decision in Shelby, we were working to advance measures that would help make sure the voting system works for all eligible Americans, regardless of who you are and regardless of where you live. In essence, here's some good make sense things. For those of you who think more internationally, name two countries in Europe in which you're not automatically registered to vote at the time you hit 18. You can't do it. You know why? Because there are none. For some reason, we're the only country in the so-called industrialized society in which one has to actually register to vote before you can begin doing it. Matter of fact, I can point to some European countries, and quite frankly, if you don't vote, you pay a little bit more in your taxes at the end of the year. It's a penalty for not voting. Mm-hmm. Shouldn't we, America's leading democracy, or the world's leading democracy, have at least that? We have a provision that says that, much like selective service, did you know that upon the 18th birthday of any U.S. citizen, that they are automatically registered for the draft? Did you know that? Did you know we have a system in place that automatically registers? Now, you don't use the draft anymore, so it's just kept at Selective Service Bureau and all those kind of things, but it happens automatically. If they're going to register you to have to go fight in the war, shouldn't we automatically register you to vote, too, to determine whether we go to war or not? Can I get an amen? Thank you so much.
And they have a ballot with pictures on them, like, so people can see who they're voting for.
Well, and let me build on that, because I think it was alluded to earlier. It is a natural thing right now, which is unfortunate, and it's going to take time to undo it. But, you know, the National Council of La Raza is a nonpartisan organization. Our electoral work, our efforts to make sure that the franchise remains accessible to people and that we create the channels for people to be registered and ready to participate, is that voters who are eligible should be able to do that. It is up to the parties and the politicians to then come and court those voters and convince them who they should vote for. That is not my job. So it is one of the tragedies of the current debate is that basically who fights for access has been politicized, right? And partly is that these measures we're seeing, and they take different shapes in different places, because frankly, while the majority of the culprits that are very evident in this repressive effort are of one party, the other party has not been fully excused from advancing its interests in different circumstances. When that's the case, being able to leave the voters by the wayside. It just happens more on one side or the other. So it is true that at the end of the day, it depends on us, right? And so part of what all the facts that are coming up about not only repressive measures or diminishing early voting or moving polling locations, and now the added layer of a foreign government intervening in our election, is that I hope that we all take part in an awakening of our civil society to assume again the reins of our democratic process. Because part of what's happening right now is that out of frustration, many people are tuning out or just leaving the democratic process to the side, the electoral process in particular. And what that's doing, and Shelby's only one piece of that puzzle, is that right now politicians are gaming the system. And I think that that is a theme and a trend that most Americans would oppose, regardless of what stripe they bear, right? The fact that we have politicians who, by whatever measures they implement, hours, locations, redistricting, and a number of other things, they are in fact trying to determine who votes for them, as opposed to being voters, the ones who decide who represents them. And I think that at a visceral level, most Americans would not be supportive of that notion. So I think that there's an opportunity to reignite civic participation, but to also, as organizations, as active individuals, to make sure that people have the tools to express that and hold people accountable. Because imagine right now, without the preclearance of Shelby, there are 8,000 or so voting jurisdictions in this country. So imagine any one of them at any given time being able to do something that games the system in a fashion that goes against the interest of the voters in that jurisdiction. And what is the ability, what is even the capacity, now that it has to be after the fact, for organizations like the Brennan Center, the LDF, and others, to actually be able to sue every one of those places that does that, and to do so after the fact, after they've affected people. So in many ways, it's how do we create the and expand the ability for us as voting Americans to be able to turn the system on its head, or if you would, actually put it back on its feet, because right now it's upside down.
So, Clarissa, I want to kind of jump in here with Myrna and then continue this conversation, particularly as we get this confirmation. Legal recourse. I mean, is there a legal recourse? I think what I'm hearing Clarissa say is time to go back to the streets, right? Reenact another Selma. Get people out the door because of this feeling of disenfranchisement. But what about legally? I mean, do we have any more legal recourse?
I mean, in order to have a path forward, we need to be able to identify the problem. And when I look at what happened in 2016, I see four kinds of voter suppression. The kind that happened because of discrimination, the kind that happened because of administrative problems / incompetence, the kind of administrative problems / incompetence that was fueled by discrimination because somebody just didn't care enough to make sure they did it right. And then I see legal suppression. So let me talk a little bit about what that is. So like one example of what I would call legal suppression is the fact that there are 4.5 million Americans living and working in our communities who cannot vote because of a criminal conviction in their past. That is something that is lawful. That is something that if we want that to change, we're going to need to do that in the legislative halls through our constitutional amendment processes in the states. We've tried to do this via the lawsuits. Didn't work out so well for us. If I want to talk about the kind of discrimination that occurred, the kind of suppression that occurred outright, sometimes there are legal means to this. One of the things that I'm thinking about is when Florida didn't want to extend its voter registration deadline, notwithstanding the fact that there was a hurricane that made it almost impossible for people to register to vote because there had been a state of an emergency. I'm very proud to have represented the League of Women Voters in that case. We got that period extended. That is an opportunity in which the courts are receptive to that because it's very hard to explain to somebody why when the governor orders people to evacuate, you can then go and say, oh, it's their fault that they couldn't submit their form in time. Then you have the kind of incompetence / administrative problems. That would be like what happened in North Carolina with the voting machines. This is not something we don't know about. There are 42 states in this country that use voting machines that are way past their lifespan. They have a recommended use of, between 10 or so years. 42 states have them that are older than that. We wouldn't use flip phones that are more than 10 years old, right? If we want to have the best democracy in the world, we need to pay for it. We need to invest in it. And the kind of technological failures that happen are entirely predictable. They're entirely preventable. This is something that we can demand more of our election officials, and we should. And then there's the kind of what I would call incompetence fueled by discrimination. And that would be what happened in Texas. I want to be very clear. I have won the Texas case 4 times. And we still had voter suppression that happened because of the law that was passed. Notwithstanding a court order saying there needs to be a way for people who do not have the kind of identification needed to be able to cast a ballot that will count, to cast a regular ballot, we had at least 88 counties in the state of Texas have incorrect information on their website days before the election until we basically came down on them like a rain of fire, telling them one by one, this is the kind of hard work that has to happen when you don't have Section 5. We literally had people at LDF and at the Brennan Center going on every single page of every single county in Texas to make sure that all of the voters got information, and we had to keep telling them, you need to change the kind of information. And if we are going to have the best democracy in the world, it doesn't come on the cheap. It doesn't come without resources. And it doesn't come without all of us getting together and demanding it. But one of the things that I think is something that we can't forget is that there's not one way to fix every problem, and we need to be able to identify what that problem is. Hillary alluded to the Brennan Center's proposal on automatic voter registration. I think that's a great idea. That's a path forward. I think one lesson that was learned is that the voting public wants something to aspire to, and we need to have affirmative reforms. I hope everybody in this room learns more about automatic registration, learns more about our antiquated and racist laws disenfranchising people with criminal convictions. BrennanCenter.org has a lot of them. But these are things that we can do in the state while Congress is going to do whatever foolishness it's going to do. We need to not forget the sort of opportunities in state courts, state legislatures, to try and make it happen while we are battling the battles that we need to fight in Congress.
I know, Stephanie, jump in real quick.
Okay, just quickly. One, you know, it's amazing to me that we continue to be surprised when things like this happen. You know, when we expand the vote, you see the vote suppressed. I mean, we've seen that with Reconstruction. We saw that with 1965 Voting Rights Act. But just, you know, when you look at Chief Justice Roberts' opinion related to Shelby, he mentioned a number of times the importance of federalism and state rights. In 2017 and 2018, we have 38 governors' races in this country. Not to mention, we have the opportunity to change the legislative identity in our states. And so focusing on the importance of getting voters prepared for that and what it means to elect officials at the state level, I think is very important. I also think, especially as it relates to communities of colors, we need to look at running people as Republicans. Continuing to think that one ideology of a party is going to get you the outcome that you're looking for, I don't think that that's a strategy that can work any longer. Nor do I think that we need to continue to spend resources primarily on boots on the ground and marches. As Reverend knows, it takes a lot of money and a lot of organizing to actually plan those mobilizations that oftentimes only happen that day and don't carry forward. The propaganda machine in this country is very serious, but the communication mechanisms to our community, more so in people who are outside of the Beltway, I live in Ohio, and so I can tell you the narrative in Ohio is not at all what you hear here in the DMV. To have resources go not to the mobilization machine, but to the communications and narrative building and storytelling machine, I think is going to be very important moving forward if we're going to get voters to understand the importance of their rights.
So I want to sort of take this last few parts of this conversation then and just get apply all this, right? And I want to go back to Reverend Jackson's analogy of the robber versus the robbed versus the robber, right? So what we're facing right now is the confirmation of the Attorney General's position. And the Department of Justice has traditionally held authority over enforcement. So all of this conversation that we're having here is really important. But the conversation that's going to happen in the DOJ will be significantly important, particularly the persistence and the enforcement of all of the areas that have been discussed.
Nicole,
so let's talk about that.
Back to the essence of this Confederacy issue is a white male Christian ideology. Those were not Christian at the fight to get inside the tent. Mm-hmm. Those were female at the fight to get inside the tent of protection. Black, Latino, Asian, Native American. Is a very narrow, it looks at America through a keyhole and not through a door. Mm-hmm. These two big ideas, free people, not free people, mm-hmm. Confederate versus the Union. As I listened to the Myrna emerging after the 65 Voting Rights Act, is that they're taking advantage of the South, the complex. They're beating up on us, Myrna. And so they kept on this idea and finally got the Roberts Court. I know we raised it, but they raised it in Minnesota, too.
Right.
They raised it in New York, too. They raised it in Michigan, too. So why pick on us? So part of the narrative of the Shelby decision was stop just picking on us and apply it to them. Right. Also, in that narrative, and once they got the numbers up, the day that they won the suit, They filed a case in Texas that day, right?
Yep.
They read it.
That's right.
They moved 868 precincts between 2013 and 2015.
Right.
And the shifting of those precincts shifted the voting alignment in terms of voting access. So I repeat that a lot of the energies that all the – it's intriguing to focus on the Putin piece of this situation.
Right. But I want to focus on –
But the terror at home is real.
But I want to focus on, Reverend, and just kind of stay there and anybody jump in.
Sure.
The Senator Sessions mm-hmm. has said that the Voting Rights Act in and of itself was an intrusive piece of legislation. And post the Shelby County decision basically said – it was good for the South, to your point, mm-hmm. right? So I don't know if it was good for the Confederate or what that was meant by that, but he said it was good for the South.
Right.
So given that, are we going to further invalidate the efforts that are being discussed here by the appointment of an attorney general that may not have this as the landmark or, you know, the prime focus or part of the focus right. of that office?
Well, let me begin by saying a couple of things. One is the role that the Attorney General's office plays, that the Justice Department plays in protecting our voting rights. We mentioned that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, and the preclearance section in particular, has to be, you have to be pre-cleared before you can make changes. The division that handles that at the forefront is the Department of Justice's Voting Rights Section. It is the Attorney General that will decide how that section is structured and who will run it, and how vigorous they'll be in actually suing places that misbehave. That's extremely important when we think about, again, the role of the Attorney General. Jeff Sessions, unfortunately, is someone that has voted against many of those provisions. Now, here's what you're going to hear in terms of the propaganda.
Now, I got to make sure to know we are at Brookings Nonpartisan.
That's right,
independent.
That's right.
So everybody knows that this is a healthy dialogue. Go ahead, Dylan.
Let me also say we
so I had to make sure that was on the tape.
And actually, let me say this, something to think about as I go on to finish making my point. An appointee is not elected. And as such, it is not a partisan issue as to whether you support someone who's an appointee who is just simply an extension of policy.
That's right.
So in essence, the NAACP is nonpartisan as well. We are a 501c3 organization, and we oppose Jeff Sessions. So in essence, just to make it clear for you, we can talk about that more just a little bit later.
All right.
But you get my point.
Great point.
So in essence, as we're thinking about the role he plays, look at the role he has played. Now, we'll say that he voted for reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act in 2006, and that would be true and a matter of record. But I'll also tell you, those of us that worked on that reauthorization will tell you that he actually announced 2 days before the markup by the Senate Judiciary Committee that he was going to move an amendment to eviscerate Section 5. He said that, and anybody will tell you, staff and otherwise, that behind the scenes, he was a tyrant. He was trying to do everything he could to weaken those provisions because he is a big federalist, in essence, believing that if the federal government has any control over these processes, you've undercut the authority of the state. And we're states' rights because mm-hmm. states' rights were used to actually set up the disenfranchisement mechanisms in the first place. States' rights were utilized to segregate communities by race and ethnicity. States' rights have been used for some of the most awful things that have ever happened in our society against a group of people, regardless of race, gender, or ethnicity. It was done in the name of states' rights. So in essence, it was only the enforcement of the Constitution at the federal level that was able to override that bad behavior. Mississippi didn't change its mind. Mississippi had its mind changed. Mm. And even then, they fought back every step of the way with all kind of commissions and whatnot. Y'all come to my next lecture. I'll tell you all about that, too. But you get the point. So as we're moving ahead on this, we're talking about what we can do. We're going to have to fight to make sure those provisions and protections are in place. If they're trying to move somebody in place that we know it does not have the ideology or the commitment or demonstrated background to be able to enforce the laws the way we think we need to, we need to do everything in our power to shut them down. And in essence, it is the U.S. Senate in its advice and consent power that's going to determine whether indeed Jeff Sessions or anyone else is going to serve as heads of these agencies, part of the cabinet, are going to put them in that place. So let's ask ourselves this question as we look at each and every one of them. Do they support our notion and understanding of what liberty and justice for all looks like? Or are they, like in so many of these cases, actually, at some point or another, we can point to the former governor of Texas, by the way, who wants to eliminate the very division of government he's now given the responsibility of running. Can I get an amen there too?
That's right. I didn't know you became pastor.
one thing that I would say, it's, you know, look, anybody who has looked at Sessions' record knows that if you look at all these, a lot of these cases we've talked about, a lot of the recourse that to one extent or the other the courts have provided, the common thread among many of these cases in terms of who had to step in as a referee was the Department of Justice. Given Sessions' record, just the facts of looking at that record, I think, leads us to believe that that referee is not going to be there, or at least not a referee who's going to be guarding the best interest of the voter, right? And so that does that mean that you just let that go and look elsewhere? No. The fight is the role of civic society here, civil society, and all of the organizations that are part of that is to hold the Department of Justice accountable to do its job as the protector of the rights of all Americans, and particularly the most vulnerable. Just because somebody has one record or another, in the event that he does get confirmed, doesn't mean that he gets let off the hook. That means that he has to be held accountable to the standard that the job requires he fulfill.
Larissa, can I make a point?
Yeah, and just let me wrap up with
this.
But I also want to make sure that we look at the positives or the opportunities. People mentioned the state level. There is nothing preventing us from trying to hold secretaries of state accountable in a different way. Right now, they tend to get evaluated for the actions they take to restrict voting, voter purges, et cetera, et cetera. But pushing that they should be evaluated on the number of eligible voters on their state that actually are voting. What is that percentage? The number who are registered, who are eligible. The number of hours people have to wait, not just across the board, but equitably across the board. And those are actions that we can take at the state level. For schools to make sure that they're registering their eligible seniors before they graduate. So while it should not be the job of civil society it's alone or of non-governmental organizations to protect the right of every fellow American to vote, we will continue to do that job and to hold our elected officials who are responsible for actually doing that job as well accountable to do that.
Right. Reverend, last word here, and then we got to
I was simply saying that in many ways, Jefferson, Beauregard, Sessions, Davis embodies the whole range. If you look, it's a Roe v. Wade for women's rights, workers' right to organize, deport 15 million people, make more difficult Latinos to vote, wall versus pathway to freedom, Bertha. So to call him, it's sidetracked calling him racist, is diversionary from just how deep and profound is the Confederate ideology as a point of view. The two big ideas, Confederate versus Union, free versus slave, every issue progressives can mention he has voted and stood against that is his point of view. He has a right to that point of view. We don't have a right to sit still while he does it. And to answer your question lastly, we have no choice but the litigation, legislation, demonstration. Every civilized, nonviolent means we can use must be used to protect our gains and go forward. We have no choice.
Wow, let's give the panel a round of applause. Before I offer just a soundbite about our program at Governance Studies, I just need to lay out some protocol. There was a lot going on today in Washington, D.C. Our president-elect held a press conference. We have hearings on the Hill. And we at Brookings, surprisingly, a shorted space to hold our next event, which is a press conference around some of the activities that happened today. So what we're going to do is dismiss our panelists. For those of you who are press, they will be available in this hallway. For those of you attendees, hopefully they're not going very far. And they've left materials, right? For everybody, the testimony of Cornell Brooks, the president and CEO of the NAACP, is available. But I'd like to leave you with one thing as we leave here. We at Governance Studies, this is the work that we do. This is why this panel is very important to us. We have scholars that are working on voting rights issues. We hope to actually do more and to be responsive in real time to what this government is presenting to us going forward. So we hope that you will trend on voting rights and you will follow us at Brookings.gov and Brookings generally to keep in the know of the conversation that we are trying to have here and hopefully have many more of these types of conversations. Did you all find this very useful? Yes, let's give them a round of applause here. And thank you very much, everybody, for coming.